This last week, in the news, there was a couple of articles about the changing of school dress codes in the East Bay. And it seems to be specifically related to cities that start with the letter A. Alameda, Albany, both did this. And so it's been a topic of conversation in my house around clothes, like, why do we wear them? A fair question. What do they signal? And why does it matter? And as we've been having these conversations, I have remembered a time in my life when clothes absolutely mattered. I was a young man, I was about 20 years old, I think I just turned 20, and I was the director of youth ministries at an Episcopal church here in the Bay Area. And one Sunday, the rector of this congregation, after service, said, Phil, we need to talk, if you could come to my office. Yeah. So I said, okay. And so he said, a couple weeks ago, during the Eucharist, you came forward to receive communion, and you had a baseball cap on backwards. And he said, there was a parishioner here who was deeply offended by that, because for him, you were intentionally disrespecting the space and the people and the reason that we're gathered. And that you're leading the youth in that direction, as well as being a witness to the congregation. It was a spirited discussion. And one of the things that I wondered was, so does Jesus, does he talk about this? You know, does he address wearing hats in church? Which he does not. And then he said, you know, Jesus doesn't, but when you're entering into this space, it's like you're entering anybody's home. And so as a sign of respect, you take off your hat. In this case, you are entering the Lord's house. I said, okay, that I can understand, but all these women of the parish, they wear hats. And I know they respect Jesus. And I said, as I've been thinking about this the last week, I've been just, I have so much compassion for this man now. Like, what he had to deal with. Oh, goodness. I just remember, though, at the end of that conversation, it came down to, it is custom, it is tradition, and so we do it. And I remember leaving his office feeling diminished. And it wasn't because I couldn't wear my hat in church. That was not it. It was because I think we were right on the cusp of a really important conversation about the relationship between God and the human heart. And we blew right past it. So why do we hold these traditions? What is it? Why do we do this? And I think that as human beings, over time, we develop these practices, these rituals, in part because it's a way to survive, right? We develop rituals over time in order to make it to the next day. And I don't know how you feel about this, but I often find it can be harder to survive with and around other people. And so because of the challenges of what it's like to be in community, we come up with ever more complex rituals and traditions, which can be helpful. They can be incredibly useful. And they aren't always. And so this is one of the challenges then that we face, is what to do. Well, let's think about it this way. Form and function. Often as human beings, we become so obsessed with that, whatever that form of the custom is, that even though it may have begun to slide away from function, we continue to do it. One of the definitions of tradition is something that has been delivered from one generation to another. And sometimes we just carry these traditions on even if we have lost sight of their meaning. Do you want to talk about prayer book reform now, Ruth? Because that's one of our challenges, and especially as a church, right? This is one of the great areas of meaning for us, is that when we participate in all of these traditions, we are actually participating not just with the people in the room, but with the generations and generations of believers who have practiced this way. We touch with words and with actions the traditions of centuries. The challenge is, and this is one of the great gifts of the 20th century scholar Yaroslav Pelikan, he said, the challenge is that we carry on sometimes the dead faith of the living rather than the living faith of the dead. And this nexus is where we find Jesus this morning. All right, we have finally emerged from the last 5 weeks of our sojourn in the sixth chapter of John, and we are back in Mark's gospel. Can I get an amen? Thanks be to God. I love John's gospel. And 5 weeks and one chapter was sufficient. And so here we are back in the gospel of Mark. And what's happened is the Pharisees and some religious scholars have traveled from Jerusalem out to the sticks where Jesus is with his disciples to see what this itinerant preacher and teacher is about. And when they get there, they find that his students are not washing their hands before they eat. Now, to the Pharisees, this is not just gross, right? This is actually something that is ritually unclean. They are defiling themselves by doing this. But I think a little background is actually really important. Otherwise, it's too easy to just glide across the surface. So, important to know, the Pharisees are a first century scholarly sect, and one of their beliefs, and I think it's really compelling, so it has to do with how you understand the priesthood. In Exodus, one of the commandments given to the priests is that before they approach the holy space for the sacrificial meal, they are supposed to ritually wash their hands and their feet as they approach. It is this act of coming clean so that they can approach the holy. What the Pharisees said was, we really want Israel to be a holy nation. So what if this act wasn't reserved just for the priests of the temple, but almost akin to a priesthood of all believers, that everyone, as they approach this act of bringing food into this holy place, they were to wash their hands. Remember also, this is a time of military, economic, and cultural occupation by the Roman Empire. And so what the Pharisees were desperately trying to do was to preserve and defend the people's use of God's law. So this is the context then that we find Jesus and some, though not all of his disciples, who are not washing their hands before they eat, and therefore becoming defiled. Defiled. It's a pretty powerful word, and so I want to unpack it a bit Because my fear is that if we don't, we will go off in different directions. The definition of this word, defile, is to make common. To defile something is to make it common. It's to take something that is sacred, that has been set aside, and pretend as if it weren't. It's to take something that is beautiful and wondrous and to trivialize it. This is what Jesus then takes a hold of as he engages the Pharisees in this discussion of what it is that defiles. But what's fascinating to me is what Jesus doesn't do. Jesus doesn't say, oh yeah, people don't get defiled, or Jesus doesn't say, there is no evil in this world. He challenges them, and he challenges us about its source. It's far easier, he says, to point outside of oneself. And to do this, he invokes the prophets, in this case, the prophet Isaiah. And Jesus could have probably invoked any of the prophets, right? They routinely rail against hypocrisy. In this case, the hypocrisy of our lips as opposed to our hearts. Right? They did this all the time, whether it was about the solemn assemblies or the fasts or the use of incense. None of those things were bad. It's just that the people of God had confused the form for the function. They were obsessed with that particular, forgetting the use that it was intended to have. And so, that's what's happening here, and it gets a little bit fraught, because the Pharisees, like many of us, once we have found something that we believe works, because most of these practices worked at one time for a people, it is really hard to let go. But Jesus is clear. It is not the extrinsic, it is not the external that trivializes the experience of being human. It's not what we wear. It's not what we eat. It's not what we read. It's not what we watch. It's not who we love. It's the twisted parts of our heart that distort the goodness that God desires. And so we get this array of destructive practices, envy and slander and folly and pride and licentiousness and adultery. And I wonder if at the root of all these, there actually is a desire for something good, whether it's justice or dignity, or being known, pleasure, or intimacy. But we twist these out of our own hurt and fear, and it comes out in ways that are destructive to ourselves and to others. I think we hear this morning because Jesus is trying to get our attention, to warn us, to alert us that these customs and practices that we have been handed and that we may be handing down, they may help connect us, they may help us remember, but in and of themselves, they do not make us good, and they do not lead us to perdition. But we hold on to them so tightly, whether it's washing our hands or wearing the right clothes. And we pretend as if that is a stand-in for the place in our hearts. So maybe it's when we actually step aside, and when we hold up the places that are tender and twisted, that are fractured and distorted, when we come to places like this, and we hold up our hearts to the light, that the shadows that grip and bind us are loosened. And we set aside all these things, and we hold up our heart, that's just maybe when we get to encounter God.